Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 16th of September. In this hour, we devote time to a group of people that are not enough time is devoted to, middle school students. Our guest is Bernie Shine, and he's written a book, If Holden Caulfield Were in My Classroom, Inspiring Love, Creativity, and Intelligence in Middle School Kids. Bernie has been an educator for over 40 years, the principal of three different schools in Mississippi and South Carolina, before he taught full-time at the Padea, I believe it's called. I don't speak Greek, forgive me, but he'll correct me if I'm wrong, the school in Atlanta, which is a very interesting school that was private and quite creative. He has taught creative and expository writing, literature, drama, and social studies, continues to teach creative writing now to adolescents and adults, and he has a master's of education degree from Harvard with an emphasis in educational psychology. His previous book was titled Open Classrooms in the Middle School. Middle school is hard enough for young people. They've just entered adolescence. They're struggling to fit in and find a group where they belong. They actually have to sit in a classroom and learn, and perhaps everybody can learn something this hour from the teaching methods of Bernie. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we concentrate on this age group, and perhaps you, we have a lot of educators listen to public radio, of course. So if you have experience working with this age group, or if you've raised somebody in this age group, we'd love to hear from you this hour. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you're using a computer and you want to send a message via email, then you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Bernie. Thanks so much for being with us.
No, thank you, Kathleen. It's very, very nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. Let's talk about just this age group for a moment. I do think, having raised a middle school student and spent time volunteering in middle schools, that we do neglect this age group. And it's such, for teachers who teach this group, they love this age group. For those of us who are raising middle school students, we think, oh, this is so hard. It's so hard. We neglect them, I think.
I don't think there's any question about it. I had a school, my former school principal, when I first began teaching, 40 years ago, and he found out I was teaching. Of course, back then they called it junior high schools.
Right.
And he said, Bernie, do you remember anything about junior high school? And I started thinking, and I said, almost nothing. And he said, nobody does. he says it's just a real blank spot when you get to be an adult for most people. And it really is neglected, and you're right. Frankly, you've got to be a little crazy or want to fill up on the Prozac to teach them, and then it's a lot of fun and it's exciting. There's no question about it. For somebody like me, or for a lot of middle school teachers, we love them.
Mm-hmm.
But for parents and most adults, and frankly, most teachers, they'd really like to go to the moon for those 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Or AWOL, or leaves of absence. I'll tell you what I think it is, Kathleen. By the time they get to be, we adore the kids, of course, and we're very protective of children as adults, and, we really like to see them as innocent and as not having been hurt at all. And, of course, by the time they get to be 12, 13, 14 years old, or 11 even 10, well, they have been.
Mm-hmm.
And, these little minor traumas, most of them, are necessary and ordinary and natural. But that doesn't mean they're not painful.
Mm-hmm.
And, anything from sibling rivalry to failures of ambition, not getting a part in the school play, being picked last on the softball team, social rejection, put downs, being excluded, picking on people, being picked on.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's done that by then.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're not even talking here about the unnatural, extreme traumas of neglect and abuse, which affect a quarter of the kids in America across socioeconomic levels. But what happens is, and they've experienced even friendship and betrayal, unrequited love.
Sure.
By that time, puppy love.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happens is we get them, And they've experienced those, and in a way, I like to call it, in a positive way, repressed wisdom. Because they've had these things happen to them, but they don't understand it at all. I'll give you, if I can use one example here, I will often get stories from kids this age about having been unable to cry at a grandparent's funeral.
Right.
And they feel very guilty. They judge themselves harshly. They feel like everybody at the funeral is looking at them, and of course they're not judging them. They're judging themselves. And they don't understand it's because they love this grandparent so much it's too painful for them to face. So they cut off. Well, they carry this guilt around until they deal with it. And so by the time that we get them, they've distanced themselves from those daring, eager, innocent children they once were. And they're pretty much a gaggle of symptoms, a rookery of defense mechanisms.
Yeah. Tell us the story. I was so moved by it, of the young girl who used to comb her grandmother's long hair.
It's really touching.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that story.
Yeah.
There are two girls. The one is I changed her name in the book. We'll call them Mary and Jesse. How about that?
Okay.
And Mary is your perfect conventional teacher's dream. Not a hair is ever out of place. She scores on standardized tests in the statistical stratosphere. She is always polite. She is always respectful. She has a very healthy sense of humor. She's wonderful in her studies. Tessa is the other girl. Tessa is totally the opposite. She's artistic, brilliantly artistic. She has some learning disabilities, some ADD. She's unacademic, doesn't test well. You never know from day to day what color her hair is going to be. She's terrific in drama. She's very clever, and socially, she's a real hit because she's very funny and clever and, you know, kind of mildly cynical. What happens is that the two girls are best friends. Tessa's parents are going through a divorce. And frankly, one of the reason they're such close friends is they were neighbors and their parents were best friends. Tessa's are going through a divorce. And of course, Mary's family life is, according to Tessa, cleaver time. Okay. She parodies them. This is, of course, why. And it's also, she's resentful because Mary's mother is now taking Tessa to ballet and chauffeuring Tessa around, and Tessa feels guilty because her mother is depressed, you know, acquiring a social life, trying to get a job, and so forth.
Right.
And she resents Mary because of the help she's getting, frankly. So what happens is the put-downs begin, what I call the teenager's handgun. You know, she'll make fun of Mary's family and how they have no problems, and it's cleaver time, and parody the cheer and goodwill. And in a way, it's not that there's not a little truth to it. Mary does portray her life as perfect. And as a result, Tessa is by far the best writer of stories and poetry, whereas Mary is a great writer of research papers and footnotes. Okay?
Right.
Mary can't do a story of poem very well because she's too unrevealing. All right. Now, what happens is they both like the same guy. All right? Mary is jealous, first of all, she gets resentful because of all these put-downs about her and her family and her perfection. Then she also gets jealous of Tessa because of this boy. So she spreads the rumor that Tessa has danced awfully close with this boy at the junior high dance, and she thought the behavior, quote-unquote, rather slutty.
Oh, my.
And, you know, it really wasn't that bad, but still, right. You know. And she's exaggerated, and of course, we have a class government court system, and Tessa charges Mary with slander. And, of course, Mary is certain, has convinced herself, that she was just, she holds out her arms outstretched kind of operatically from the witness stand in the courtroom in the class. And she says, is it wrong to care? It's because I care. One of the jurors raises his hand and asks for a hearing aid, which breaks up the entire courtroom, because obviously nobody can believe this. And then what happens is this relationship continues to deteriorate, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, we're sitting in literature class, and I do think it's good that you ask about this story, because I think also the reading and writing, you'll see how it comes from all
right,
this.
Right, right.
We're sitting in literature class, and we're reading Catcher in the Rye. And Mary finally throws up her hands, and she makes a very honest statement. She says, I hate this book, and I hate him. Hmm. Well, I'm delighted, because it's the first time I've ever heard Mary hate anybody. And of course, she does. We all do. And or at least strongly dislike. And I said, oh, great, Mary. Now tell us why. And she says, well, all he does is put everybody down. Which, of course, she's been
which
doing.
Which is what she's doing.
And vice versa.
Right.
And he's so negative. Well, there's Tessa. And besides, there's no plot, which there isn't much of one, but who cares? And he finds fault with everybody but himself. He's so critical. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, also, remember, Mary is the type that will always ask Tessa what her grade is on a test so that she can reveal hers. All right? So it's not that it's not going both ways here.
Right.
All right. So, so Tessa loves the book. She's an artist. She's actually more open to literature. She's more open to herself. She knows what's going on. And she loves the book, loves the send-ups, and the parodies that Holden Caulfield, the main character, you know. And so she says, she talks about how much she loves the book. And then somebody said, well, if you don't like Holden and you don't like the book, what would he be like in his classroom? And then Tessa paused for a minute and said, gosh, Mary would charge him with put-downs. So would I. Then here is what we find out. What we find out is, I said, Mary, you sound a little angry. And she freezes for a moment. Now, what you're always doing as a teacher is listening not for what's said, but for what's unsaid. And so you, and she finally said, she thawed out a little bit, and she said, he's afraid. He doesn't call Jane Gallagher. He only courts people to be friends with who are going to reject him, which is what popularity is about at this age. And he, I said, why? And she said, he's afraid. And I said, what's he afraid of? And Tessa says, he's afraid of what my parents are afraid of. He's afraid to love.
Oh, my.
And Mary starts to cry.
Oh.
And she breaks down. She's a beautiful little girl. And she says, and I said, Mary? And she says, she holds up her finger. And she says, I am too. And she looks at Tessa. And Tessa looks at her. And Tessa says, tell us your story. And she said, which is a common refrain in the classroom. And here's then she began to tell the story of the grandmother. What happened is that when she was very, very, and see how one thing leads to another, but when she was very, and, of course, she and Tessa have rebonded now, okay? And she says that when she was little, her grandmother was just beautiful. She sounded a lot like her. And they'd make character cookies together and do everything and paint by the fireplace. And she talked about it. And then she could not cry at her grandmother's funeral. And it was because when her grandmother was in the hospital, her parents took her to see her. she was dying of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And when she walked into the hospital room, she was shocked because her grandmother had no hair. And she couldn't stand the thought of what was going on. It was too painful for her. And she never went back again to visit her. She always made excuses. And so she felt very guilty.
Mm-hmm.
When her grandmother died, she had really numbed off and cut off by then, and she felt very guilty about it. So she told the story, and she said, I want to stop talking. I want to go write. So she went and wrote, and 3 days later, she comes back, and she begins her story. And the first line is this, and this is how you can't rationally, that this is how education is an irrational, messy process, that you can't, that the idea that you can transmit reason from one generation to another is just absurd. It comes from inside as well as outside.
Mm-hmm.
And she said this, the first line, for hours, I would brush her hair and talked about the silver combs and so forth on her dressing table and in front of the fireplace and then began the story. And she told the whole story. And, of course, she realized at the end that she couldn't cry because she loved her so much.
Mm-hmm.
That was the great epiphany for her. And it was very liberating. And Tessa looked at her at the end of the story and she said, oh, my gosh. And she was just weeping.
Uh-huh.
And she said, you are so human.
Hmm. And this happens in your classroom.
Every day.
Tell me how self-knowledge, and it sounds like many of the students are achieving some kind of self, obviously,
absolutely,
self-knowledge,
yeah,
leads to worldly knowledge.
Yeah, that's a great question. Because she was unable, for example, if I can just continue this example.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, she was, if you notice, Mary was not open to the literature in Catcher in the Rye.
Right.
It was too glaring, an accurate reflection, and she shied away from that mirror. Her writing, if you remember, of poems and stories was flat or giddy or operatic.
Mm-hmm.
Once she dealt with this issue that was holding her back, she was more open. Obviously, her writing soared. For hours, I would brush her hair is a wonderful first line.
Mm-hmm.
The poetry in it soared. The humor. If you are not open to one literature book or story or what have you, then it's more than likely you're not going to be open to others. Anything that pushes your buttons, you're going to close off. And, of course, those are the mirrors you need to look at. And because those are the ones you can see yourself in and grow from. Otherwise, you're judging yourself too harshly.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was more open to literature. And she was more open to other books, too. Remember, this is a girl that could never admit that she'd done anything wrong. So you can imagine her reaction initially to Lord of the Flies.
Right.
And so she's more open to that book, to a separate piece, you see. And, of course, the writing soars because it's inspired.
Mm-hmm.
And also, her friendship with Tessa now is real,
mm-hmm,
and it's positive. And remember, with Tessa is also acting out. Tessa admitted that she was putting down. Imagine Mary discovering that Tessa is putting her down because she's jealous of her.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I'm jealous of your family.
Right.
And that, of course, made Mary feel great. And they're able then to nurture each other and to be open with each other without so much fear and anxiety and competition between them. Now they're inspiring each other,
mm-hmm,
instead of just putting each other down. And so the relationships also, the relationships become more mature and more sophisticated, and they're more relaxed, and they're ready to grow up a little bit. They have gained some wisdom.
Let's pause for a moment, Bernie, and we'll welcome phone calls. Bernie Shine is our guest this hour. He's the author of If Holden Caulfield Were in My Classroom, Inspiring Love, Creativity, and Intelligence in Middle School Kids. He's been an educator for a number of years, and he taught at a multi-aged middle school classroom of 7th and 8th graders at a private school in Atlanta. The goal, to bring them out through reading, writing, drama, debate, discussion, group dynamics, class government, and a court system. And we'll take your calls momentarily as well, and your emails. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655, or emails talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bernie Shine is our guest this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. Let me grab this mouse and try to get this email. Here's an email for you. And I was a Holden Caulfield, Bernie. I hated middle school. I hated everything about it. Now go figure, I'm a teacher. It's my favorite age group in the whole world to teach. They're hilarious one minute. The next minute, they're trying to be so adult, always self-righteous and a little pompous. Loyal one minute, but quick to turn if they feel slighted. Their humanity distilled. They are underrated, understretched educationally. But I'm proud to say I live and teach in a district that does not overlook them in the least. I have three of my own, one up and coming, so I know as an educator and as a parent how easily they fall through the educational cracks. I look forward to reading the author's book. The title alone, Bernie, has me hooked.
Oh, how marvelous. Now, who is this?
This is an email that came in, and let me go down the scroll here.
Oh, this person knows these kids.
I guess. Oh, it's from Clinton Public Schools, Danny Noriega.
Well, Danny, you are terrific. You really, I bet you're a great teacher and a great parent.
Yeah. Thanks very much for getting through to us. You know, when you talk about this, it's amazing to me that this method of working with the classroom, I would think, must be very exceptional, Bernie.
Oh, well, it is. You see, what happened was that, and I think it's important that that be noted, because it's unfair to teachers to make a comparison with my situation in many places. When I came to Padilla, you know, that was 35 years ago. And, you know, nobody, it was the late, you know, we were still kind of in the aftermath of the 60s. And nobody really knew what to do with education, and much less middle school. And so I was promised freedom. It was the agreement I made. I gave up a good bit of salary in order to come here and teach. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was willing to do that for the freedom. Of course, I loved it. I'm glad I did it. But you know, I think I'm an example of what can happen, Kathleen, when the bureaucrats, the administrators, the policymakers vacate the premises. And really, where the teacher is the boss of his or her classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have to fight for that. You have to fight for it wherever you are. I used to say that, you know, I don't mind sucking up for a nice salary, I'll be happy to. But for a teacher's salary, it's just not worth it. So in a subverted, kind of perverse way, it gave me a lot of freedom because I wasn't hostage to a high salary. Now, did I want it? Of course I wanted it. But frankly, I've always pretty much had my bags packed. I had to have that freedom. Now, that worked well about, I would say, 10 years ago, 8 or 10 years ago, when things started changing. You know, administrators and people became much more concerned. Always you've got, Kathleen, and every teacher will tell you this, I'll guarantee to you, Danny Noriega would say the same thing, that you've always gonna, most parents are fabulous. You can really learn from them. They are very attentive. They're giving. You can work together. And you both love this child, and so you want the best.
Mm-hmm.
there are going to be two or three out of every 40 who are nuts. And they can be vicious. Mm. They will always blame the school.
Mm-hmm.
Now, up until 10 years ago, you could pretty much say to those parents, look, your child and you have had a problem with the school for 6-7 years already.
Mm-hmm.
You've blamed teachers every year. This is not my fault. This is your fault. You're going to have to deal with it.
Right.
Okay? Now, I will help you, and I'll do everything I can do, but I'm not going to take the blame for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even going to talk to you if this is the way it's going to be.
Hmm.
Now, what usually happened is that I was shocked, not always, but usually, because they ended up loving it. And I think it's because, looking back on it, they probably knew the same limits their children did. I don't know. But those parents are usually complicit subconsciously with the kids, and they can ruin your year.
Mm-hmm.
And with the idea of everybody covering their posteriors now, if you will, litigation, job losses, this kind of thing. Well, I don't think teachers have the same freedom.
Right.
And I don't think they ever probably, most did not have what I had anyway. But at least most could have a darn good time.
Mm-hmm.
And most were supported. But I think with the lack of respect for teachers, the lack of pay, the lack of respect for authority, I mean, the abuse and neglect pendulum has swung so far the other way. You know, a teacher yells at a kid for talking on his cell phone in the middle of class, a senior.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the senior goes home and tells his parents he was abused.
Hmm.
Then this teacher may not... will probably not be supported.
Let's go to some phone calls, and we'll start with Ed from West Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Well, I navigated one child through K-4 through the 12th grade in the MPS school system here in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a lot more structured than I think the guest is. I had some goals. The biggest goal... My goal was to create and have at the age of 18 or 19 a kind, decent, working class kid who had some basic skills. I demanded, we had her in Milwaukee French Immersion School from K-4. She then went to School of Languages and then on to Milwaukee Rufus King, where she took 4 years of Latin. And I recommend this to everyone. I wish she could have had 2 years of Greek to introduce her to mythology and Homer, but she at least got her. She was grounded in the classics, and that is so vitally important to the structure of a mind. The next thing is I wanted her to be handy, to be able to work with her hands. So before Fuller cut out all the funding, she at least got a couple of classes in woodshop. And finally, from the age of 4 until she finally threw a temper tantrum her junior year, she studied violin and music and was in the orchestra at least for 2.5 years at King. And I think that those are the influences. We can only do so much. You have to have an ultimate goal in mind, and you have to have a structure in place. But, you know, I think Winston Churchill said it best. He'd make everybody learn English, he'd make the clever kids learn Latin, and he'd make the brightest learn Greek. And I think that if you have that as a structure, you're not going to go too far afield.
What do you think of that, Bernie?
Well, I think that's very interesting and solid and well-grounded. The problem, I think, I don't think I had much of a problem with it until the last line. I don't know. I think intelligence and talent are far too subtle and complex to be pigeonholed. I don't think you can say that a kid, for example, there are children who have a terrific ear for foreign languages, for French, for example, or German, And yet, they don't do well in courses. There are kids who have an unerring ear for language. Terrific poets who have who can't spell because English phonetically often does not reflect the sound when you spell it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a person who is terrible in math, very slow, stupid, but good. Was good in English. Now, even in English, however, it broke down. I was good with the poetry and stories, much like Tessa. I was horrible with the research papers.
Mm-hmm.
Intelligence is a very subtle, complicated thing, and I don't think you can say, well, the bright kid gets Greek, the extra bright, or the bright kid gets Latin, the extra bright kid gets Greek, because I don't think, frankly, that the speaker, if you will, and I say this respectfully, even apologetically, I don't think you know a child's intelligence in that very, I don't think you can pigeonhole it. And there are a lot of kids that are unbelievably bright, probably some even in the shop that she worked in with her hands, who may not be very good at learning Latin. I could even make the argument that I think there was a presupposition there that there was no structure or goals with what I did. It's actually not true. What I did had many, many, many structures. Some were improvised, but there were basic structures all the way through. The books we read, mm-hmm. the stories we wrote. I mean, my kids wrote 20 pages a week just on their stories. They had to hand them in. If they didn't, they got a note home that went to their parents.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly worked very hard on their grammar. But what we also learned is that they learned grammar better through their writing with the workbook or the grammar book supplementing that than just through the grammar book. In fact, here's how another myth about intelligence. I could have kids go through the grammar workbook or go through the worksheets or take the grammar test and ace them every time, and it would never show up in their writing. So, see, intelligence is a very complicated thing. Obviously, there were goals. We wanted to make them great writers, great readers. We wanted them to read the room, however, and who was in it, as well as they read the books.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, why read the books? Wisdom, skills, all of those things were certainly very much a part of it. But I would never have I think any child who can feel and think is intelligent, and that means all of them are. So I wouldn't put a lid on any of this stuff. I mean, you know, I would be very, very careful to follow that child as closely as I could. Now, you do have to look closely. They can self-destruct. You know, the kid in the book who throws his calculator and protractor to the winds and slide rule when he's a brilliant mathematician just because he suddenly finds that he wants to be popular and goes out and tries to be an athlete and blows it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's doing it for the wrong reasons. But he's not very smart in basketball.
Let me just go back to Ed for a moment here, and then we need to pause for a moment. Do you mind if I ask where your daughter is now, Ed? What course she took?
What course?
Yeah, where? Yeah,
she didn't listen to me. She took the carpenter's apprenticeship exam.
Uh huh.
Passed it, and now is where with 28 other thousand human beings up at the University of Wisconsin. So
mm-hmm.
she didn't listen to Dad. So the I think that, you know, she was the one of five co-valedictorians at King,
mm-hmm.
and maybe her life will turn out. I'm
sure
very much
will.
A man of the working class,
right?
And she has decided to follow the world of ideas.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that. Thanks, Ed, for your call. We'll welcome more phone calls in just one moment. Bernie Shine is our guest. His book is If Holden Caulfield Were in My Classroom, Inspiring Love, Creativity, and Intelligence in Middle School Kids. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bernie Shine is our guest, 800-486-8655. Before we go back to phone calls, Bernie, I want to ask you, at one point in the book, you talk about your own education, and you say what was omitted from my education, your education, you offer your students.
Yeah. That's exactly right. I hated school, Kathleen. I must admit that. I was really bored. I liked the social. I liked the athletics, and I liked to play and have fun. But classrooms were really, really boring to me, and probably because they didn't have anything to do with me, and they didn't have anything to do with my questions from the first grade on, you know. My questions were, what makes the sun shine? Why does the wind blow? How come Paul can jump to the third rung of the monkey bars and not fall on his behind, and I can't? And, of course, I'm too young to know this because he's a head taller than me. Why do girls sit down to go to the bathroom? Certainly, if you've got nothing but brothers and you're 5 or 6 years old, then that's going to be an issue when the bathroom is in the classroom, you know, off to the side. And there was just a number of questions. And quite frankly, in the first grade, I'm sitting there and we're reading, we're in reading groups. And the teacher, and also I had been brought up in a family in which when people asked questions a lot, but it was because they didn't know the answer. Nobody ever asked questions they knew the answers to. So I'm sitting there in the first grade, and we're reading this book called The Red Caboose. And the teacher says, what color is a caboose? Well, I point to the title and I say, it's red. Okay?
Right.
Then she keeps asking all these other questions. All right, then the group sits down and I'm listening to the second group, then the third group, and she asks them the same questions. Okay, so I go home and I tell my mother that my teacher can't read. And, I mean, I'd never seen that before. Why would you ask somebody questions you already knew the answers to, especially since I had so many? And frankly, I don't think anybody answered my question. You soon forget those questions. And I think that's another reason why by the time they get to middle school, they're so crazy. All right? I think they've forgotten who they are in that way, too, just like I did. And so, look, I remember speaking, Kathleen, at a high school of gifted kids in Atlanta a few years ago. And we're talking about this same kind of thing, self-awareness, honesty, creativity. And there's a very charming kid named Yuri in the back row of the auditorium. And he raises his hand, and he says, Mr. Shine, could you expound on the distinguished, prominent nature of Southern literature pre-Margaret Mitchell? Okay, well, after I inflated and let the air out a little bit and stepped back, yeah, step back and give a guy room for something like that, you know? Well, so I said, what's your name? And he said, Yuri. And I said, Yuri, I can't help it. I'm puzzled by this. Do you really want to know the answer to that question? And he smiled. He was very charming. And he said, well, no, of course not. So I said, well, I've got to tell you, I mean, since I'm a teacher, you're not dumb, but that question is really dumb because it's not yours, you know? And I said, where'd you get it from? And he looked at me. And he said, my teacher gave it to me. Well, I felt like an idiot because it was very clear. His teacher was sitting right next to him. And he pointed to her. So I looked at him and I said, well, Yuri, you've outsmarted me, that's for sure. You've outsmarted your teacher. But then it occurred to me, and I said, but Yuri, it just hit me. It dawned on me. You've really outsmarted yourself, too, because you don't know anymore what your questions are. And you are one of these kids. You're the bright, gifted kid. You're scoring, and statistically, you're in orbit. Mm-hmm. You know, you're on your way to some Ivy League school or some great school like the University of Wisconsin or Michigan or what have you, or Chapel Hill or Duke, and you have no idea what you're interested in. You have no idea what your questions are. The fact is, Kathleen, you can walk into any classroom in America just about, and if you say, what do y'all want to learn? You know what they're going to respond? Math, English, history, or science.
Mm-hmm.
It's like saying the universe. They have no idea. They've forgotten and lost who they are. That's what happened to me in school.
Mm-hmm.
And so it bored me. And then when I got into teaching, it was almost as if I'd parachuted into a friendly field, because suddenly the kids were talking about themselves and they were interesting, and their themes were universal. Their themes were literary. They just didn't know it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Lyle from Northfield, Minnesota. Hi, Lyle.
Hi.
Hi, Lyle.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Oh, yes, sir.
Good, good. I'm down here in the valley up in northern Wisconsin, sitting in a beautiful RV park down here on the lake shore of Lake Superior.
Oh.
Hey, you want some company?
Yeah, really?
I'm a retired teacher, and I taught shop. You know, that was our everyday name for it. They call it industrial tech now. But it was, you know, I have a lot of skills, too. So I'm sitting in my trailer, which I, you know, bought brand new, but it was just a plain old trailer, and I turned it into a toy hauler. So my wife and I have motorcycles, and we wheel them in here and head out with our big Ford diesel pickup and go anywhere we want to go and just have a lot of fun. And even though these Middle East people want to charge us a lot for diesel, I don't care. I'm going to enjoy it, you know. I'm not going to let them take my fun away, you know. But we have a good time, and I just enjoy listening to this man. He apparently is an English teacher, a language arts teacher, and boy, he could make a lot of money today teaching school with the great attitudes he's got. But he'd have to be in the right school, you know. But teaching industrial tech or shop was a lot of fun for me. You know, I didn't, you know, they kept cutting it and cutting it till, you know, I didn't have to do any written assignments of any type anymore. And so we just focused on learning kids how to, you know, expose them to machinery, you know, and how to make things primarily out of wood. I mean, I taught every subject area, but we really focused on wood. Something about wood. It's just a natural material, and you can do a lot of neat things with it.
Oh, sure.
I'd have the kids use power machines. You know, I never was afraid. You know, I always figured out ways to rig them up so that they wouldn't be dangerous. And then I tried to instill in the kids the old self-preservation idea, you know, and I found that most kids don't want to get hurt. They don't want to hurt anybody either.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really blessed, you know, because I'd never had any serious accidents. And I got a loud applause from my fellow teachers on the day I retired for that thing. But I think that was a blessing from God, you know. But it was a great activity. And I got involved in negotiations and all that stuff, too, you know, and picked up the attitudes of, you know, administration and stuff towards salary and things like that. And I just realized that was their job and they had to do it. But I always told myself, you know, if they had their way, they'd probably double our salaries, you know.
Right.
And what about the possibility for the creativity that you had in the classroom now? I know you have things to say about No Child Left Behind. I know there are a number of teachers who are really concerned about standardized tests and the number of tests and the increasing number of tests. It requires you, actually, to teach in a certain way, doesn't it, Bernie?
Yeah. The fella, Ed, that was who we were just listening to, I think. Yeah.
Before that. This is Lyle.
Lyle, I'm sorry. Yeah. Lyle, yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm terrible with names. But Lyle, yeah, think of somebody, you know, one of the key lines that he said, this is a terrific teacher, I'll guarantee you, wonderful guy. And one of the lines he said is when he was touching about wood, you know, and what you can do with wood. And, you know, clearly he really cared about the kids, the discovery that they didn't want to hurt anybody or get hurt. And now think of imposing a standardized test on what he was doing. I mean, it's just oppressive. Yes, the standardized test is a huge problem. No Child Left Behind leaves every child behind. And I think Uri, in the story I told you a few minutes ago, is an example of that. Because, frankly, if my irrigation system goes bad in my backyard, you know, it takes me longer to identify the problem than it does to go to Lowe's and get a clamp.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, what they do with these standardized tests is they ask the kids questions for them. They're not interested in the kids' questions. And this makes these kids, especially the ones who do well on, fodder for any charlatan's imagination. And it gives them no moral rudder, no, I don't, of course, know anything about Donald Rumsfeld or Robert McNamara other than what you read in the papers back during Vietnam and, of course, at the beginning of the Iraq War. But there was something about both of them when you read about them that was similar. They both were technological whizzes. They would both, I will guarantee you, you know, ace all these tests when they were kids. And yet, it was as if they were more, you know, the fact that the moral rudder seemed to be missing. And I think that people, I think we have to be very careful because, you know, not only are we asking the questions for the kids, which means they don't have to identify the problem. The hardest thing about any research or inquiry, they don't have to identify the issue, the conflict. But not only that, we're giving them the answers. Mm-hmm. And we're just saying, choose one.
Thanks, Lyle, very much for your call. Michelle is next from Black River Falls. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on what he was saying earlier, really hit home with me. You really can't peg one person as smarter than the other because, right. For example, I have a husband who graduated top of his class in medical school, and he can't spell worth a darn. I'm a creative mindset. I'm an artist, and I can spell his difficult medical words where he can't. So, you know, you just can't peg one person as smart. Also, we took an online intelligence test or IQ test, and mine was higher than his.
Really?
Did you gloat? I hope so.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Thanks very much for the call.
Yeah. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we have time for maybe one or two more phone calls. And our guest, I should give you the name of the book again, just so you can be sure and have it. It's If Holden Caulfield Were in My Classroom, Inspiring Love, Creativity, and Intelligence in Middle School Kids. Bernie Schein, S-C-H-E-I-N, is the author. Matt from Williams Bay, hi.
Yeah, hi. Bernie, I just want to say I really agree with things that you're saying.
Thank you.
I did a program in New York City. I did a fellowship, so I taught in the South Bronx for 3 years.
Wow.
And, you know, in talking about kids' emotional and social well-being, I'd have them write stories in Writer's Workshop, and all this stuff would come through that were, just like you said, things that they didn't understand what was really going on yet.
Right.
But they were able to sit down and think and process those thoughts and share their stories if they wanted to. And the other kids in the class would just sit there and listen, and it just brought such community to the classes.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, that sounds great, Matt. And, you know, are you still teaching?
No, actually, I was just teaching in Mexico City for 2 years at a private school.
Uh-huh.
And I'm working on a young adult book right now.
Oh, young adult book?
Yeah.
Oh, well, so you're writing yourself.
I'm writing myself, and I took off for a year. The one thing about middle school teaching is the energy gets zapped out of you. So after 5 years, I'm taking a year for myself.
Believe me, I understand. That sounds great. And you know, if I can, Kathleen,
sure.
Matt, the one suggestion that I have when I talk to people, and I think you did this naturally, but I found myself after a while when I would get their stories saying, okay, you can do anything you want to, kids, but think. Don't think. Mm. Only feel, and then let's get to the bottom of that feeling. Now, of course, that's hard to get to. But once they do it, then their stories seem to cohere. I'm wondering if Matt found any of that himself.
Yeah, I did. I didn't really have to tell them to think. I would just...
Tell them not to think.
Well, actually, I would give them guided questions. Like, for example, when we'd be going over the book The Giver, which is a great book that's kind of an introduction of philosophy for like young teens, mm-hmm. or kids that are 11 years old, mm-hmm. I would ask them to imagine that they are Jonas and they're not seen in color, and they have the realization that they see in color. So they would write about that, and then we would sit and we would share the stories, and they would connect things within their own lives to, like, this imaginary story that they're writing, this piece of fiction. And when I was in Mexico last year...
We have to stop with it. I'm sorry, but we're out of time, so we'll have to think about what happened in Mexico. Bernie, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh,
it was fun.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you. Bernie Shine, S-E-H-E-I-N. The book is If Holden Caulfield Were in My Classroom, Inspiring Love, Creativity, and Intelligence in Middle School Kids. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. Thanks to John Tretter for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for your calls. We're with you again tomorrow at 9. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.